Montana talks here. Live and local. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint. Broadcasting live across the great state of Montana, powered by the Montana Electric Cooperative Association. Your Montana Electric Cooperative, they do much more than keep the lights on for you. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
You know, somebody just asked me yesterday at this event I was at, they were like, Aaron, how far in advance do you plan your show? And I'm like, you know, to be honest with you, I don't want to plan the show too far out in advance because we want to talk about the big news of the day. And obviously today, several major news stories that we need to get to here this morning on Montana Talk. So thankfully, we didn't have anything planned for today. But now, boy, have we got a full show for you. Starting with earlier this week, we talked with Jennifer Patrick with the Milk River Joint Board of Control in advance of that big town hall meeting that took place in Malta earlier this week, talking about the St. Mary siphon failure and what the next steps might be, what the next steps could be. Well, I've got the information in front of me right now. St. Mary Canal siphon response update and next steps. Obviously, this is we're talking about the Milk River project. We're talking about, you know, this massive irrigation system, which is really referred to as the lifeline of the High Line. But more importantly than having the information at my fingertips in front of me right here, we've got the area manager for the Bureau of Reclamation that is in studio with us right now, along with the operations and maintenance manager for the state of Montana, Ryan Newman. First off, we'll start with you. Great to see you. Thanks for popping in the studios here, especially a little last minute. How'd the meeting go earlier this week, the town hall meeting? What was the biggest message you wanted to communicate or hear from the people?
Well, we actually had two goals going into the meeting. The first one was to be as transparent as possible and share with the public everything we knew and what we didn't know. It's obviously was an extraordinarily unfortunate event. It wasn't 100% unexpected, i.e. it was old aging infrastructure. We anticipated something was going to happen at some point, hence the reason we've been working on it prior to this event occurring. So we really wanted to get up local in the community, in front of the public, in front of everybody, and let them know what we knew, path forward, some key decisions that have been made, some timelines that we're looking at, what the water year is going to look like this year in terms of our operations of the system, and also some projections going forward into next year, water year 2025. And then also want to hear from the public. We want an opportunity to hear from the water users and other stakeholders up in the basin and receive their feedback. So it was a good meeting in that it was well attended. That's key. And we were able to get a message out. And then also we're just going to keep doing press releases. And again, being transparent. We want folks to know what we know, what we don't know, what impacts really could be, and then our timelines and path forward for getting this thing ultimately up and running again.
Yeah, obviously, this is something that folks have been talking about for quite some time, even on this radio show. So obviously, folks within the BOR have been sounding the alarm. Folks here in the state of Montana have been sounding the alarm. And then, boom, we saw this failure once again. So what are the plans to come up with a permanent solution, a permanent replacement? And then why is a temporary solution not an option? We'll talk about that and much more back right after this. And again, thanks to Ryan Newman. And we've got Chris Gomer here as well from the Bureau of Reclamation. Stand by.
Hi.
Taking your calls live, 406-294-0970. Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right, jumping right back into it here. We've got Ryan Newman, the area manager for the Bureau of Reclamation, and Chris Gomer, who is the operations and maintenance manager for the state of for Montana, for the Federal Bureau of Reclamation as well. And Chris, jump in on the conversation here at any point as well. Ryan Newman, you know, one of the questions I've had is, okay, great, you know, there's finally, it seems now, this commitment to find a permanent replacement for the St. Mary siphon. But I think, as Jennifer Patrick told us earlier this year, we're looking at maybe by the end of next summer, 2025, at the earliest, that it's permanently replaced. Why was a temporary solution not really an effective option?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And that was a decision that we made last week. It was a very, very difficult decision because on the surface, it seems like, well, hey, if there's any opportunity to provide any amount of water, something's better than nothing, right? Because right now, with the complete failure of the St. Mary's units, we aren't able to provide water over the Milk River project. And those who are familiar with the system know that how significant that St. Mary water is for the overall Milk River project. I mean, it provides about 60 to 80% of the overall water budget on any given year. So obviously that's huge. The Milk River, again, just is generally quite water starved. Hence the reason there's an irrigation project up there. It's just so unreliable. And so when it failed, obviously that's the end of deliveries from the St. Mary's for this water year, this current irrigation season. So they're reliant on everything that exists right now in Fresno Reservoir and Nelson Reservoir. And so we're thinking, all right, is there a way to somehow get water going this year? The siphon, for those who are familiar, it's two pipes. It's two 90-inch pipes. You'll hear us refer to them as barrels from time to time. There's a thought that, is there a way to maybe stand one of them up and move some amount of water over? Or maybe is there a way to pump out of the river and lift it up? It's about a 200-foot lift. That's a huge lift. So it's what we did. As soon as the site was safe, we got a technical team convened and on site. We had a whole host of engineers and technical specialists, multi-agency team on site doing a technical evaluation, looking at alternatives to get water over. We set a couple of criteria prior to making that decision. One was we had to be able to move at least 200 CFS, that's cubic feet per second of water. Anything less than that, it's absolutely not worth it.
So even if you had the money for the temporary solution, it's okay getting the work crews, getting the work done, and then is the juice even worth the squeeze? Are you even getting enough of a trickle out of there to even make it worth the while instead of focus all your efforts on this permanent replacement? Chris Gomer, you've been, I think, in the Montana office, what, since 2010 with the Bureau of Reclamation, if I remember right?
Yep, that's
so
correct.
I was looking at the slide deck that you guys shared at the town hall meeting in Malta. It's on the Milk River project website, and man, I looked at those photos of those pipes. They look like rusted out tailpipes on an old pickup when you look at this thing. How many miles of rusted out tailpipe are we looking at here?
Yeah, and the funny part is the pictures don't do it justice. When you get on site, the damage is much more severe than you can really see in the photos. So there's about 3,200 linear feet of pipe. So there's two pipes, so total about 6,400 feet, so a little over a mile of pipe there. That west side is completely blown out and damaged. The foundation of those two siphon pipes is not workable for a potential temporary solution. So is really moving on to focusing on, hey, can we pump out of the St. Mary River, which has its own issues related to ESA and bull trout and cost to power the pumps to push water. And as Ryan said, you know, the squeeze or the juice just not worth the squeeze at that point.
So a mile of pipe takes over a year to get put in?
So really the hard part is fabrication, right? This is big pipe, whether it's steel or HDPE, you know, getting pipe ordered, fabricated, delivered is a long-term lead item. So it's first initial estimate was 6 to 8 months to get pipe on site. I think that has come down a little bit, but we're still working through that with Jennifer Patrick on the board and local nationwide fabricators to get pipe on site as soon as we can.
Yeah, and obviously the whole congressional delegation, as you'd expect, as should be there, they're supporting this funding for this. Governor Greg Gianforte just announced the state portion of the funds. He just had a kind of a town hall meeting yesterday in Malta himself. I don't know if I've seen any of the readouts on that one yet, but so what's the next step, Ryan or Chris?
Yeah, well, first circling back to that temporary decision, the decision not to provide temporary water, I just want to circle back to that just because it's such a huge decision. The main reasons that we moved away from it was, one, really the only way to do it was to lift water 200 feet through pumps. Second, that would have to be done either via, obviously, electric pumps or diesel generators on site. It would cost a minimum of $20,000 a day, likely a fair bit more than that, just to operate it. And then also, you know, we're looking at more than $3 million, four, even maybe up to $5 million just to get it put in place. And then we have to be able to get put in place right away this fall so we can start moving that water this next year. you know, if you're moving 200 CFS after conveyance loss, maybe 170 CFS reaches it over, and you don't gain a whole lot of days of irrigation. And then the other thing with that is, and as Chris, you know, accurately pointed out, the lead time with getting this 90-inch pipe, that's not off-the-shelf stuff. That's stuff that has to be fabricated and made. If we were to go into a temporary option, that gets in the way physically of us getting to do the permanent replacement. So it jeopardizes our ability to meet our objectives of getting this whole thing up and running again by the end of 2025. We'd ultimately like to have the system in place by September of 2025 so we can start fall movement to water next year. That allows us some operational flexibility next year with Fresno Dam, and it also allows us, obviously, to have water provided in 2026.
All right. Well, I appreciate both of you dropping by. I understand you got to run. We've got some other news to get to here. But if there's some important information that you still wanted to get out that we didn't get a chance to put out there yet, stand by and we'll come back to you for some final thoughts after the break here. Quick break here on Montana Talks and then back to it. I'm going to give you the latest on the Horse Gulch fire north of Helena, now at 1,000 acres, according to Sheriff Dutton. And
talking about the issues that matter to Montana statewide. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
One of the questions before we get into this, to the update on the fire north of Helena, the Horse Gulch fire, I spoke with Lewis and Clark County Sheriff Leo Dutton just a few minutes ago with the latest update, now at 1,000 acres. So I'll talk more about that here in just a few minutes. But one of the questions, I was getting a cup of coffee earlier this morning, and I ran into Paul Mushaven, one of the breakfast flakes on the country station in Billings. You know, he's on the same floor as our Montana Talk studios are on, and was getting a cup of coffee, and he was asking about, you know, this aerial firefighter that was tragically killed, lost her life, gave her life trying to, you know, basically save yours and defend, Montana for us. And so we just can't thank her and her family for the sacrifice. But one of the questions Paul Mushaven has, was that a Bridger Aerospace aircraft? Was that one of Tim Sheehy's aircraft? And I said, no, I checked with his folks yesterday because that was one of the questions I had too. I did not include that in the update that I shared on our Montana Talks website. I solely just kept it on, you know, the major news points that we'll get to here in just a few minutes. But I then ended up getting a phone call from Tim Sheehy, and just a powerful phone call from him at that. He actually knew the pilot. He ran into her at the Denver airport just a couple of weeks ago, had a cup of coffee, just remarked at what a tremendous pilot she is, and just, you know, what a small community the aerial firefighting community is. So I'll share that with you guys here in just a few minutes. But Ryan Newman, I know we wanted to talk next steps, and thanks for sticking around for just a couple of more minutes for us here. I know we wanted to talk next steps a little bit more, but first, you've got a facility right there where this fire broke out, so you guys had to step into kind of your emergency response plans as well.
Yeah, this fire, when it first started, it was very close to our facility, and, you know, obviously, when there's a fire near a hydroelectric facility, we're very much engaged. And we did have to go and evacuate our Riverside campground down below Canyon Ferry Dam and get everybody moved out. And that's actually become a staging area for the local first responders. And then, of course, our excellent staff up there are very quick to provide any sort of support that the local responders need. And I do believe they reached out to us for some spill response items that could be utilized in the reservoir where that tragic crash occurred. And then also, you know, we stand ready to put everybody on notice on other campgrounds along the reservoir. And if we have to get folks shuttled out of there real quick, we'll do that very quickly. We just go at the lead and take direction from the local first responders and work very closely with them.
Yeah. I also have, a caller on the phone lines with maybe a quick question here. I think it's about the Idaho water situation, but I believe you guys only cover Montana, but maybe I'm mistaken. But either way, let's see quickly what Chuck and Scobie has for us here. Chuck, did you have a quick question or comment? Thanks for calling in.
Well, I do have a comment. It's actually about the Malta thing. I'm just curious because, you know, I know you guys are the Bureau of Reclamation. I've been following the water situation in California where they did put the new aquifers that were supposed to go for agricultural, and they put it in for drinking water. I'm just, you know, it sounds like these aquifers should have been replaced years ago. Why, you know, there was a big name change from from engineers to reclamation. You know, now we're fighting with, you know, like putting the Columbia back to natural. Isn't reclamation putting it back to natural? Isn't it, might be higher up, not wanting to put this?
So kind of this question of, yeah, we're seeing, you know, kind of deliberate attacks that against infrastructure just like this elsewhere across the country. No, I certainly see your point there, Chuck, especially if you look at the Columbia system and how they're trying to tear out the lower Snake River dams. Obviously, that's the political folks back in Washington. But, yeah, no, I think, though, Chuck's point, regardless, is something that folks within BOR have been, I mean, you guys have been sounding the alarm about the need to upgrade this infrastructure for quite some time. But anyway,
that's a great point. And one thing you got to recognize with reclamation, you know, we were formed back in 1902, and there was a very large building era where very large and sophisticated infrastructure was constructed in this country at the turn of the last century. And when you go through a very large building area like that and build this infrastructure that we see today, unfortunately, it's going to start reaching the end of its functional service life at about the same time. You know, so we get criticism, hey, how come you wait till something fails to respond and it get attention, when in fact we're actually doing incredible amounts of O&M daily on all of our systems. We inspect annually and do a lot of work to replace all the time. You know, things are going to fail because you can't replace everything that was built in the building area.
Yeah, well, you see it in every government agency. You've even seen it in the military, where it's not a problem until it's their problem. And no matter how many times you tell them, hey, we got this issue over here, until Washington makes it a priority. Well, I know you guys got to run. Chris Gomer, your thoughts, what's the next steps? We touched on it a little bit before that last break.
Sure. So we made the decision to not go after a temporary option. So now we're fully focused on complete replacement. There's a couple of near-term and long-term actions associated with that. Near-term, we're trying to award a contract to get a contractor on-site immediately to remove the existing pipes, kind of lay back the vertical cut slopes you see in those photos. For public safety, there's a lot of people interested in this. There's a lot of people coming on-site taking a look. There's also a significant amount of material in the river itself we need to get out of there. So that's a river remediation action. So that's near term. Long term, we're working with the Joint Board of Control and Jennifer Patrick to procure pipe, get a contractor to install pipe, get a contractor to construct a bridge, with an ultimate goal to get a siphon back up and running next fall.
So in the meantime, what about having their drinking water? What about irrigated land? Are they becoming dry land farmers in the meantime?
So 2024, they have about until the end of July for irrigation this year. So they still got a little bit of water stored in Fresno and Nelson to use. Real impacts start rearing their head in 2025. We are solely relying on natural flow in the Milk River and whatever storage we can move over from Saint Mary at the end of next fall. So definite impacts to the irrigation community. At this point, we think we have sufficient supply to not impact municipalities.
All right. Well, thanks again for popping in. Ryan Newman, the area manager, and Chris Gomer, the operations and maintenance manager. Great to see both of you. And, hey, you know where we're at. Anytime you want to drop in on important updates. And, because you guys oversee a whole bunch of great terrain out there with your hydropower facilities and more. So I'm sure there's a lot more to talk about in the months ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's see. Where do we go next here? Well, first off, hey, if you want to jump in on the conversation, definitely want to sneak in some of your phone calls here this morning as well, 406-294-0970. I mentioned chatting with Lewis and Clark County Sheriff Leo Dutton about an hour ago. I talked with him on the phone, and basically, this Horse Gulch fire, there's some key updates he gave me. One, they do believe that this was a human-caused fire, whether it was carelessness with a campfire that wasn't fully extinguished or fireworks. They do believe this was a human-caused fire, so they are searching for who is responsible for this fire that broke out. And then, of course, he gave us the latest details. They may be releasing the name and the identity of the woman who lost her life, the aerial firefighter who lost her life while fighting the Horse Gulch fire north of Helena. Her body was recovered yesterday. And according to the InsaWeb fire information website, at 2 o'clock this morning, it was at 600 acres, but Sheriff Dutton told me that fire is now at 1,000 acres. He did tell me that the pilot who lost her life, she was contracted out of the state of Idaho. So I've actually got a joint statement from Governor Gianforte and Idaho Governor Little on our Montana Talks website. Sounds like the pilot is from the country of Brazil. We don't have her name yet, but they've been working to identify the family, obviously, in the meantime here. And then, of course, Sheriff Dutton just shared this, just a remarkable story. There was a man who was nearby, heard the crash, saw the crash, saw the plane in the water next to the cliff, jumped into the icy water, the cold water, jumped into the water, because that's below the dam, so you're getting that cold water that comes out from below the lake, right? So he jumped into the cold water. He could see her in the aircraft, as Sheriff Dutton described it, and tried everything to try to get her out of there. But it sounded like she had already met her fate tragically. But man, it's just another reminder of just the dangerous work that these incredible aerial firefighters are doing every single day. I remember driving up to, Kalispell for the Governor's Cup, the Chamber of Commerce event last summer, about 1 year ago, and I could see these dive bombers just in the acrobatic work they do. I mean, just right next to Arleigh, Montana, just dive bombing down the side of that mountain, dropping the retardant on the flames, all to protect you, all to protect us, and lives and home and livestock and so much more. I mentioned, Paul must have been asked if that was a Bridger Aerospace aircraft. It was not. This was a, as Peter Christian told me from KGVO Radio in Missoula, the aircraft was an Air Tractor 802. And so basically it's, for those of you that are familiar with the crop dusting airplanes, if you've ever seen a crop dusting aircraft, like, for example, John Mackard in Scobie, he took me out to the airfield there, showed me the plane that he flies when he's working as a crop duster. It's basically a similar plane, if I'm not mistaken, except for it's outfitted with the pontoons underneath it to be able to fight fires. So that's what this plane was yesterday. Now, the bigger super scoopers are coming in. If they're not there already, you should see those aircraft on station. And I believe at least some of those are Bridger Aerospace aircraft gearing up out of the Belgrade Bozeman area. So I'll play a very brief conversation that I had with Tim Sheehy, Navy SEAL veteran. Obviously, you know his name because he's the U.S. Senate candidate this year. But powerful conversation with him about these aerial firefighters and the sacrifice, the risks they take for you and for me. So we'll get to that right after this, and then see what else folks want to talk about across Montana.
This is where Montana Talks Ag with Lane Nordlund.
This week, the Montana Stock Growers Association is in San Diego participating in the Cattle Industry Summer Business Meeting. For Stock Growers President John Grandy, creating policy for the future of Montana's livestock industry is essential.
Well, there was not new policies, but existing policies, but how we're going forth in enacting those and working on. We've been working on better instrument grading for over 25 years now, but that's still something that's in process, and we're still working on that, getting that grading more objective, more consistent. That's an important thing. Another very important thing is just here recently, the CME came out with new expanded limits on both the live cattle and feeder cattle contracts. We have a lot of concern about those. And fortunately, the CME folks have been very willing to listen. We're having productive conversations with them about trying to take a closer look at those, because those expanded limits, they lead to the possibility of huge daily moves in those contracts, which if you're using those as a hedger, obviously that opens you up to a lot bigger margin calls. We have a lot more people moving towards the LRP, and which is a good thing, and one of the things we're working on is improving that LRP contract. But the CME, to me, they're actually shooting themselves a little in the foot. If there's more risk of higher margin calls on CME contracts, that's all the more reason for people to move to LRP, and there should be a place for both.
From San Diego, I'm Lane Nordlund.
Hey. This is where Montana talks. Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right, let's see. I'll share this audio of my conversation with Tim Sheehy here in just a second. But first, we've got a caller on the phone lines. Ryan in Big Fork. Ryan, thanks for the call. And, yeah, what did you want to share with our listeners? Ryan, are you there or are you losing cell coverage? Can you hear me?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Hello. Oh, hi. I just got in the truck and I heard the story about the aerial firefighter. I'm an aerial. Just got on my days off yesterday, so I hadn't heard about it until your show. So I just wanted to give my condolences to her family because it's a real tight-knit community, you know, that we have. And I just wanted to see if, you know, you had any questions about it. I don't know anything about the accident. I'm just a fellow aerial firefighter, and we have a tight-knit community that we just, when I heard this 15 minutes ago, my heart sank.
Yeah, man. Well, I'm sorry that you had to hear it here. Yeah, because you're probably, you know, working a crazy schedule, crazy shift. First off, thanks for what you do, and thanks for the sacrifice you make. What type of aircraft do you fly, and what is it like? I mean, I was trying to just describe the acrobatics. Very risky career field.
Well, I will tell you, I've been doing it for 20 years, and I think everybody in this industry knows somebody who has not made it personally, like good friends. And I am the same way. I fly a four-engine jet tanker. So we don't scoop in the rivers. We have to land at the tanker base and get a load of retardant.
The larger aircraft look more like a passenger jet almost when you're flying, right?
Yeah, it's like you said, you use the word acrobatic. I would say go even one further and say you're almost become a test pilot because you're flying at such a certain, I mean, that retardant is only viable when you fly at a certain speed at a certain altitude above the fuels. So you're real slow and real low in a heavy airplane. And the ridge with.
Yeah, I think your cell coverage is breaking up a little bit on us there. But, what's one more thing before we lose cell coverage with you that you wanted to share?
Oh, nothing. I just want to thank you for putting that out there. And, I just want to give my condolences to our family or any of the my fellow aerial firefighters out there listening that I'm thinking about them on my time off.
Yeah, well, thanks for what you do, and it's important that we talk about this. I got a phone call from Fred in the Flathead, who I got to meet finally in person. You know, he's called in the show a few times. I'll see him on Twitter, X, get some tweets from him, and he's worked as a wildland firefighter. And you know, he was just saying how, you know, oftentimes if a contractor is, you know, loses their life and is killed fighting these fires, well, their sacrifice is tremendous, but yet because they're contractors, they don't get sometimes the recognition and the honor that they deserve. But I'm glad that Sheriff Dutton and law enforcement started with that dignified transfer as they escorted her remains back to their facilities in Helena, and so hopefully that honor continues. All right. Well, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Let me go now. This is a Navy SEAL veteran and aerial firefighter, Tim Sheehy. Obviously, he was the CEO of Bridger Aerospace, but recently stepped down so that he can focus full time on the U.S. Senate race. But I got to go. He had a grand opening for his hangar for Bridger Aerospace there at the airport in Bozeman in Belgrade. And got to see firsthand. But that whole event, all of the proceeds from that event went to make sure that our fallen aerial firefighters, that their families are taken care of. Let me cue up this audio here for you a second. Let's see. That was kind of the point that I started with in chatting with him earlier this morning.
Yeah, sure is, Aaron. And actually, I'm just driving into the hangar now. And I heard you talking about it, so I figured I'd ring in. And thanks for bringing it up because, like you said, we got a lot of brave pilots out there that put their lives on the line every single day to protect us. And this is the cost of it sometimes. I knew this pilot personally. I just ran into her in Denver Airport about 5 weeks ago just by accident. We knew each other anyways, and we shared a cup of coffee. And great lady, great pilot, career pilot. But It's a very hazardous environment that we operate in out there. And sometimes even the best pilots, you know, it's a tough world to fly in. So I do still fly. I'm no longer CEO, as you said. I stepped down because I got to focus on saving America here with the campaign. But actually, our planes just went up there late last night to fill in the gap of after her terrible accident. They had to ground some of the aircraft. So was not a Bridger plane, but we are now there helping to make sure we get that fire under control to protect Montana.
So you are still jumping in the cockpit as an aerial firefighter when you can, even in the midst of this very important U.S. Senate race.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not flying full shifts this year. Obviously, I used to fly full-on shifts. Now I'm a reserve pilot. So basically, you know, what happens when you're fighting these fires is you have limitations on how much you can fly in a day and how much you can fly in a week. And if our pilots hit those limitations, you got to call in a reserve crew. So basically, they call me up and say, hey, we got a pilot who's out of crew day. Can you make your way to Alaska or Canada or Texas or wherever we are? Can you fill in a day or two to reset the crew? So that's all I'm doing this year. I'll probably get, you know, maybe 8 to 10 days of firefighting in this year. But unfortunately, as you know, I got a pretty busy schedule this summer as we got to focus on the elections.
Yeah, and you know, obviously the public, you know, officials aren't you know, haven't identified, at least last I've heard, you know, the pilot. But you talk about what a small community this is. You knew her personally, just shared a cup of coffee. I think about how small of a community the military community is, but then the special operations community is even smaller. I mean, as somebody who's served with Green Berets and Navy SEALs, and it's like, man, it's like, you know, it's kind of like being from Montana. Everybody knows everybody, or you can find somebody who knows somebody. Right. And the firefighting community, the aerial firefighting community. What was that incredible movie? Was it Chances Are that was filmed near Libby back in the day? And
Always.
Yeah, or Always. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, it was Always. That was, yeah, wrong movie reference. But Ben, it just shows the connection with these aerial firefighters and what a small community, what a family it really is.
Yeah, it is. You know, aviation is a small world, and aerial firefighting is even smaller. And as you said, you know, we've focused on raising money for those families because, you know, when an aerial firefighter is killed in the line of duty, that there's not a support network around it the way there is in the military. You know, we don't have the Wounded Warrior Network. We don't have the VA. We don't have a big system that swoops in and takes care of the family and gives them a check to help them deal with their funeral expenses and help them deal with health care expenses. So we started a foundation specifically to do that, and I'm proud to say, you know, we've helped dozens of families in the wake of injuries or tragedies like this. But yeah, hopefully Montanans, you know, sometimes when it's a slow fire year or winter time, we all forget about wildfire. We forget about the thousands of men and women that are out there on the front line keeping us safe during the summer. The summer's going to be a really nasty fire season. It's already starting now. This heat wave is drying out the entire West, so people just got to be careful and watch what they're doing outside because you know, if you start a wildfire, someone else is going to have to come in and risk their life to put it out. So just be careful and keep those folks in your minds because, and most importantly, keep them in your prayers because they're out there protecting you.
That's right. That's right. What, I know I got a couple minutes here before I take a break, and you probably got to get running as well. But Tim Sheehy just agreed to get this a phone call from you here this morning. And then I'm going to get to Fred in the flathead. I know he's got experience on this front as well. But, you know, and you know, obviously the family hasn't been identified yet, but we're, you know, it's been reported that her family's overseas, and so they're working to identify her family. But if you could say something to her family, and unfortunately you've been in this tragic position before, you know, losing your fellow SEALs and service members, what would you say to her family?
She passed doing a very important mission, and she was protecting others. You know, at the end of the day, she was protecting other people. She gave her life to save other people's lives, and at the end of the day, there's no greater calling than that. There's no greater calling than putting yourself in danger to protect others. And you know, her family, I know, was very supportive of her aviation dream. She was a lifelong pilot. So this was her dream. She was a great pilot. And I think, as sad as it is, that they're going to know she's in a better spot. She died doing something she loves.
Can other folks contribute to your fund to help these families of fallen aerial firefighters? How can, and if so, how can they do it?
Yeah, Montana Firefighter Fund is a website, also the Wildland Firefighter Foundation. Both those organizations help aerial firefighters and their families in the wake of injuries and tragedies like this. So, you know, as folks remember, you know, during the war, we had lots of great nonprofits that helped us warriors as we came home. You know, the wars are over now. And now, you know, we have another group of young people out there doing the same thing, putting themselves between us and danger. So donate to protect them and help them out.
All right, Navy SEAL veteran, aerial firefighter Tim Sheehy, an honor to get your phone call this morning, and our best to the whole aerial firefighter community out there. I know a loss of one is a hurt to all.
All right. We got a break coming up right now, and then we'll get to your phone calls, 406-294-0970. Carrie and Kalispell, you'll be first up. And then we got phone lines open for you as well. So if you call in right now, should be able to get to you before we run out of time today for today's program. Coming up Friday, tomorrow, we're going to have William Perry Pendley joining us for a few minutes. He was the Bureau of Land Management Director under President Donald Trump. He also served in the Reagan administration. We'll talk the Chevron deference decision out of the U.S. Supreme Court. And we'll talk about spotted owls and why the timber industry was never to blame for the spotted owls. A brand new story on that front.
Broadcasting live across the great state of Montana, powered by the Montana Electric Cooperative Association. Your Montana Electric Cooperative, they do much more than keep the lights on for you. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right, let's jump back into the phone lines here, 406-294-0970. Or you can send us a quick message on our Montana Talks app, and we'll try to keep a close eye on that one before we run out of time as well. All right, 294-0970. Carrie in Kalispell, thanks for the call. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Aaron. Thank you for what you do. And Tim Sheehy, I know he's not there anymore, but thanks for what he does. And we're voting for him and really rooting for him. So my brother-in-law, Jim, used to be a wildfire spotter. And when the ground crews, this is back in the day, old school rurals, right? They would fly over, and when the ground crews could not get through or find the fire, they would throw rolls of toilet paper out the plane to show the ground crews where to go to beat the ground fires. Isn't that great? What a great idea.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you could almost just see it like a streamer through the air. Yeah, you got to get creative, exactly. Right? Yeah, yeah.
And what made me upset about the Montana, the Glacier Park McDonald fire, I said, where if they throw toilet paper out so the ground crews can find it? So I just busted up laughing. But, yeah, he was a very, very good pilot for the fires.
You know, we just, when we talk about the pilots, I mean, and the smoke jumpers and the hand crews, I mean, just everybody all around. But, you know, Tim mentioned that movie Always, which was just such an incredible movie. Well, Richard Dreyfuss, is that who it was that was in that? I mean, just such a legendary movie. And, you know, part of it was filmed near Libby, Montana. And so that gives us kind of a sense of it. But man, you look at some of the history. I mean, some of the history of the smoke jumpers. I mean, they had, you know, many of them ended up serving in the CIA over in Southeast Asia and everything, because they're just incredible men of courage and competence and innovation. Yeah. I mean, like you say, you lose your comms, You just got to figure it out. You got to figure out a way to get the message out there, right?
Exactly.
Well, thanks. Yeah, well, thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. 406-294-0970 is the number for you. Real quickly, here's part of what Lewis and Clark County Sheriff Leo Dutton had to say when I spoke with him briefly a little over an hour ago. You know, because obviously they've had some evacuations, so a lot of important information to put out there.
Well, good morning, Aaron. I appreciate you having me on the show. We'll start with how this began and carelessness. Someone either didn't put a campfire out or they started with fireworks, so this fire is human caused. And that saddens me about the responsibility of people. And we're doing investigations. The Forest Service is doing a lot of investigation to see if we can find the person responsible for this humongous now 1,000 acre fire, threatening homes, threatening people's lives, and that, tragically, as you already indicated, cost the life of one aerial firefighter. It's just terrible. So that's where we're at. We're looking at probably 170 homes that have been evacuated. That's not the number of people, and it might even be larger. The fire is somewhat calm this morning, but it's not out, and it's still dangerous. We have a lot of roads that have been blocked. So the people that have left, we're patrolling the area, and if we catch you in there off of your property, we're going to kick you out. You, as your Constitution says, you can stay on your own land. You have the right to refuse to leave. We respect that. But most people can't do that. Most people go out and they need to take a drive to see what's going on. And you can't do that because we have said to the people who left, we will ensure the safety. Do our best. Make sure your property is safe. So the there's quite a lot of activity, Aaron.
So if you're in that Hauser Lake kind of area, I guess what would you kind of define as the perimeter? What's an easy kind of general way to think of what that perimeter would be? Or is it just kind of just stay away from that portion of Hauser Lake, that area, Canyon Ferry, just in general?
Right now, the road is closed at what they call a Canyon Ferry Village, and it's closed all the way to the Broadwater County line. We have signs up. We have deputies. We have highway patrolmen there. And we have other areas blocked off. The Forest Service is closing trails. There's a road called Jimtown Road that you can still use if you need to get across to some other mountainous areas. Today, we have some larger aircraft that are super scoopers, so to speak, of aerial water applicators coming in. So we're going to need more of the lake. And what we don't need is somebody who thinks that it's fun to zoom along on a jet ski or impede those aircraft in any way. Yesterday, back to the aircraft, I don't know what caused the accident, the fatality, but probably in an hour I will release the name. The difficulty, Aaron, is that she is from Brazil, and that's where her family is.
Mm.
And I needed to beat Facebook about saying, oh, pilot killed, all of that. Can you imagine learning on Facebook that your mom was killed? Mm. That's the difficulty of beating that.
Yeah. All right, and thanks to Sheriff Dutton for providing that update. There's more to follow. Full audio on our MontanaTalks.com website since we just ran out of time.